Welcome to Coastal Cafe. I'm Marianne Wagner, your host today. Coastal Cafe is a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. We have with us today Melissa Watkinson-Shutton, the Equity, Access, and Community Engagement Lead with Washington Sea Grant, and Michael Chang, an Associate and Racial Equity Lead with Cascadia Consulting Group. Both are marine science and policy professionals who have dedicated much of their careers to creating a more diverse, equitable, and inclusive marine and environmental field with programs across the Salish Sea region. Mike leads and supports multiple environmental projects on climate adaptation and resilience, community engagement, and environmental equity. Melissa is a lead in DEI policymaking within the marine science and policy fields and served as co-chair on the City of Seattle's Environmental Justice Committee. Welcome, Melissa and Mike. Would you like to introduce yourselves a little further?
Hi, yes. Thanks for having us. My name's Melissa Chakma. I use she, her pronouns. I'm a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation, and I also descend from the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. I grew up in Washington State, and I have family who are enrolled with the Upper Skagit tribe. I consider the Salish Sea my home. I also identify as Two-Spirit, which is a term that some Native American LGBTQ members use to acknowledge their gender and or sexual orientation diversity.
And Mike?
So my name is Mike Chang, and my pronouns are he, him. I'm a queer first-generation Taiwanese immigrant, and I work as the Associate and Racial Equity Lead for Cascadia Consulting Group and work on a variety of climate and sustainability projects.
Melissa, we hear the acronym DEI mentioned in the news and in conversations. What exactly does it mean?
DEI stands for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Individually, diversity represents and embraces the demographic, individual, social, economic, and cultural differences of people. Equity is a state of being fair and just, and inclusion acknowledges the inherent worth and dignity of every individual within any given group or structure. Collectively, when we hear it talked about or are working to advance DEI, what we mean is that people who have been underrepresented, underserved, or marginalized are reflected and appreciated, are able to fully access and participate in programs and decision-making processes, and who feel that their unique backgrounds, needs, perspectives, and ways of knowing are welcome and respected. Underrepresented, underserved, and marginalized people can include Black, Indigenous, and people of color, members of the LGBTQ community, immigrants and refugees, people with disabilities, and low-income people.
So why does DEI matter?
So there are many reasons why DEI matters. From an ethical perspective, many environmental groups are implementing projects or making decisions that have tangible impacts to communities. And because of that, it's really important to have these communities and perspectives reflected in the organizations that hold this power and have a seat at the table. From a business perspective, we also know that when organizations commit themselves to greater gender and racial diversity, that will lead to increased financial success. McKinsey, a well-known consulting group, found that organizations that are in the top quartile of racial and gender diversity have 35% more financial revenue. And finally, I think that one of the big things that comes of this is that having diversity and racial diversity and gender diversity within an organization can lead to a lot of innovation. One story that is commonly referenced is the story of Dr. Esteban Gonzalez Burchard, who's a Mexican-American physician. And he was able to identify a gene variant that was more common in African-Americans and Puerto Ricans that was associated with increased asthma severity. After he found this and published his findings, this led to a change in how the National Institute of Health funds its studies, which had largely only included white participants in their medical studies between 1993 to 2013, and has now led to the more inclusion of people of color within medical and health studies to understand the different types of sensitivities and disparities across health outcomes and racial groups.
Well, thank you. Well, many of us are uncertain about the steps needed to turn dialogue and intention into action. What advice would you give to people that want to integrate the principles of DEI into their day-to-day lives? Any suggestions?
Well, I believe that we all have opportunity and responsibility to support the advancement of diversity, equity, and inclusion either within our own communities or your place of work or the field that you're working within. One way to begin is to build your own knowledge and understanding of other people and their experiences. I do this by listening to podcasts, reading books, and attending public events that are written or produced by people that have different identities than myself. Some small actions you can take are to include your pronouns when introducing yourself, to be able to create a space where gender is not assumed and where all genders are welcome, or take stock of who and how you or your program are funding. Is there a diversity of representation of people and organizations that are receiving that funding? How about the people who request and represent policymaking in your area? Is there room for a broader representation there? These are all things that individuals can do to take action.
Mike, you are working on several projects on the peninsula. How are diverse communities represented in your work?
Olympic Peninsula has a diversity of many different types of communities: tribal communities, rural communities, urban communities, and communities that are dependent on natural resources. And one of the things, especially this past year with the COVID-19 pandemic, is that it's put a spotlight on many of the inequities impacting communities of all shapes and sizes, including for the communities on the Olympic Peninsula. Some of the different types of considerations includes access to internet and internet bandwidth. There's a huge disparity for rural communities and some communities along the peninsula. There has been progress made to increase bandwidth access, but COVID-19, especially with remote work, has really highlighted and put a strain on some of this. There's also considerations around economic resilience, thinking about how some communities are dependent on natural resources, are dependent on tourism. And so COVID this year has really disrupted a lot of livelihoods and opportunities for seasonal harvesting, fishing, and hunting. And finally, thinking about, there are many tribal communities on the Olympic Peninsula, and tribal communities have really been feeling the impact of COVID really hard, both in terms of addressing COVID preparedness and response. COVID has also disrupted tribal subsistence and commercial harvesting, fishing, and ceremonies that often bring families together. And so thinking about this work, there are a multitude of considerations, both in terms of a strain on capacity and attention that can be drawn to other types of projects when people are dealing with COVID within their community, thinking about how livelihood and economic changes affects people's ability to engage. And also, again, as we're working, how do we make considerations and build them into projects when we're engaging with communities that might not have strong internet bandwidth and access to that?
Well, speaking of communities on the peninsula, you have both worked with tribes on climate resilience projects. What are tribes generally doing about DEI?
I would say tribes have been some of the leaders working at the intersection of climate change resilience and equity. We know that climate change disproportionately affects the health and well-being of tribal communities, and tribal communities often experience some of the first and worst impacts of climate change. And in recognition of this, tribes, especially tribes across Washington State and the Pacific Northwest, have been some of the leaders in climate resilience and climate planning, oftentimes taking a holistic approach in how they address climate resilience. For instance, many of the tribes are creating comprehensive solutions. So no matter your role, what your role within the community, such as if you're a fisher, a hunter, artist, a youth, or elder, that every single person within the community benefits. There's also ensuring access to traditional and unceded areas, and that those access is continuously maintained for future generations, especially considering that there are many policies related to ocean management, such as seafloor mineral leasing, that might be affecting access in the future. And finally, many tribes are also thinking about this future generation and how we can empower the knowledge transfer from elders to youth within communities as well.
I would add that thinking more broadly about Indigenous groups, there's been a really big push to have better and increased representation for Indigenous peoples and our histories. I see this happening a lot with doing land acknowledgements where folks are acknowledging the Indigenous stewards and lands of waters, but making policies that are local, which include traditional knowledge, and by having more spaces where Indigenous cultures are celebrated. And this, I think, is particularly true here in Washington State.
Melissa, tell us a little about your background and how you chose to focus your time on DEI policy building.
Mike here and I have been friends and professional colleagues for over 5 years now. And our first opportunity to work together when we were both the Mark Hirschman Marine Policy Fellows funded through Washington Sea Grant after we graduated from our individual graduate programs. My fellowship was housed at the Nature Conservancy, and Mike was working with the Macaw Tribe, but his office was actually hosted at the Nature Conservancy, so we sat side by side within that organization. It was really an opportunity for both of us to not only learn with and from each other, but to learn about the environmental field more broadly. Historically speaking, environmental organizations, you know, have a very large white demographic, and though they don't have a large population of people of color who work within the organizations. And that was an obvious experience that we had when we were sitting at the Nature Conservancy offices in Seattle. During that time, I was working on supporting different marine-related projects, but I also really felt like it was important to do something to acknowledge this kind of disparity of lack of representation of people of color and in Washington State because of the work with and in partnership with tribes for environmental organizations. It felt like addressing these disparities would be important to support better engagement across communities. Dr. Dorsey DeTaylor at the University of Michigan has conducted a number of studies to identify the racial disparity gap of many environmental and conservation organizations. She and her team identified what they call the green ceiling, which is the maximum average of representation of people of color within environmental organizations. And that green ceiling is at 16%. This means that environmental organizations on average have staff representation of at least 84% white people. The U.S. has a population of over 40% people of color, yet are capped out at just 16% within these organizations. Dr. Taylor and her team have also further identified that this racial disparity is even greater within leadership positions of these organizations. Being that I come from a diverse background and want to succeed in these organizations, it's important for me to be working on advancing DEI.
If you're just joining us, this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and I am Marianne Wagner, today's host of Coastal Cafe. We've been talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion in the Salish Sea with Melissa Watkinson-Shutton and Mike Chang, marine science and policy professionals working to advance equity within marine programs and the environmental field more broadly. And we're just talking with Melissa there. Melissa, you are trained as a social scientist, working with people as they interface with the marine environment. Are you using your skills honed as a scientist to do this DEI work?
Yes, I am. Often in order to make changes in policy, you have to be able to have data to back it up. While progress in advancing diversity, equity, inclusion can be difficult to measure, we can use social science tools to begin to capture an understanding of the people and demographics of who we're working with and who we might be missing. So for example, you can utilize already procured data through a census to get an understanding of the different social, economic demographics of a particular community. And you can then identify what are the gaps within your program or organization that don't reflect the diversity of the community at large. That's just one way that we can utilize social science tools. Okay, I'm okay saying I'm a data geek. I love maps as well. And so GIS and using geographic information systems is another way of implementing different social science data to really determine what are those spatial gaps for representation, particularly when it relates to accessing marine environments.
Excellent. And Mike, you come from the East Coast. As a science practitioner, now living in the West, you are working along the coast directly with diverse communities, building community consensus. How are communities here on the coast different, if at all?
Thank you for that question, Marianne. I'm going to start here and also offer Melissa a chance to provide some of her perspectives as well. So I think there are a lot of similarities in the types of issues and areas. For example, how do we engage a diversity of communities in a relational and inclusive manner? How do we implement policies or make decisions that elevate historically underserved communities? And how do we ensure that the organizations serving these communities have a staff that's reflective of the communities that they serve? However, a lot of the difference comes within the history and within the context. So for example, I grew up in Wilmington, North Carolina, and in my hometown, we still have multiple Confederate statues and monuments in multiple city parks named after white supremacists who led the first and only successful coup d'etat or government overthrow in the US of a democratically elected majority Black city council in the late 1800s. We also think about this through immigration patterns, and immigration patterns are also different. Thinking about what are the jobs that are available within in a region and where are immigrants coming from. I know here in Washington State and along the West Coast, for instance, there's a much higher rate and concentration of immigrants from Asian countries. And all of these nuances provides the different types of context and the histories that we work in when we're conducting environmental projects and programs. And it also shows that there can't be a one-size-fits-all approach when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Although I'm not from the East Coast myself, I've had a lot of opportunities to travel to some regions on the East Coast through work. And because a lot of my work has been engaging with tribes, it becomes pretty apparent while on the East Coast that there is a lack of tribal representation and acknowledgement in that area. And I would just say history has a big imprint on this fact. I can speak for my own self and my heritage. My tribe, the Chickasaw and Choctaw Nation, were forcibly removed from our traditional homelands as a result of the Indian removal policies that took place in the 1800s. My tribes were then forced onto the Trail of Tears from Mississippi and Alabama region to what is now called Oklahoma and can often also be considered Indian country, where many other tribes were forcibly removed to. So as a result, then we have very little representation and federal recognition of tribes remaining in the East Coast and in the South.
Yeah, you don't often think of that, but that is actually true. There isn't a lot of representation. And Melissa, you are currently piloting the tentatively named Urban Marine Program, where you are seeking community-based solutions to address disparities in access to marine food and resources within urban communities of color. What sort of disparities are you finding in our cities?
Early in our project, I worked to identify which urban areas would be an ideal site to pilot this program based on the needs of access to marine foods and resources. We ultimately identified Tacoma as being the best pilot site for this program. You know, many Indigenous peoples, immigrants, and refugees have traditional ties to fishing and harvesting marine foods for subsistence and cultural uses. However, those who live in these urban areas are often not able to access those foods or even able to practice fishing and harvesting, even if it's for foods that are different from their traditions. So the aim of this project and the program is to work with communities of color in urban areas to identify what are their biggest needs and gaps in accessing these marine foods and resources. We know that we already have many different challenges related to accessing healthy marine foods and resources as a result of toxins and pollution and climate change within the Salish Sea, and that disparity and that access can be even more challenging for communities of color and low-income people who may not know what types of fish they can harvest, where to safely harvest them. English may not be their first language, and so there may be information available that's not translated in their own first language. So there's many different kinds of potential barriers for people to access these foods and resources. And through this program, we hope to identify what those gaps are and how this program through Washington Sea Grant can partner to support those gaps.
Can you share other examples of DEI work happening in marine science and policy around the Salish Sea?
Yeah, I think there's a few examples that come to my mind, and I'm sure Melissa has many others. And I'm just providing these examples. I think these are good examples, and just want to recognize they're not all perfect and that they're all continuing to improve as well. So a few examples come to mind. The first one is the Duwamish Valley Cleanup and Restoration Project that's happening here in Seattle and King County. And in this project, there's a lot of recognition that many of the tribal communities, the refugee communities, and other immigrant communities that live and rely on the Duwamish River need to be involved and engaged and have ownership and decision-making power within that process. The Swinomish tribe here in Washington State has also been at the leading edge in developing indigenous health indicators. Our health indicators that are culturally appropriate and responsive to the needs of the Swinomish tribal community. And there is now more intentional efforts in terms of integrating these types of integrated indicators into ocean ecosystem management. There's also a lot of work in developing more responsive fisheries management policies, especially in response to extreme events and extreme years, such as this past one. And this is really important for fishery-dependent communities who are often more rural and less able to pivot to other types of industries to be more resilient.
Well, thank you. There are not a lot of ways for marine scientists to gather and discuss these issues, but more opportunities seem to be emerging. In fact, you two worked alongside many others to host the 2019 Salish Sea Equity and Justice Symposium. Was that the first of its kind in this region?
No, it was this 2019 Salish Sea Equity and Justice Symposium was built upon many decades of work from other people who work in this equity and justice space. And of people from the Salish Sea region, among others. And so we really saw this as another instance where we can continue convening conversations to ensure that our whole community and our whole field collectively are advancing the conversations and making progress towards becoming a more equitable, inclusive field.
I would add too that maybe there haven't been maybe the opportunities for gathering and having these conversations is increasing. And I would say that's likely a result of many organizations across the Salish Sea who do work in the marine science and policy realm have adopted and are working to address DEI within their programs and organizations. A lot of the times, because of the dominant culture being mostly white folks within these organizations, there aren't a lot of voices of diverse backgrounds that are included. And so one of the goals in my perspective for working towards the Equity and Justice Symposium was to make sure that diverse voices were part of that decision-making in advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion across the Salish Sea.
Well, I imagine that you both do a lot of listening in your work, but what stands out for you? What do you hear a lot?
Maybe I'll go first and then hand it to Melissa. I think one of the things that I'm hearing a lot from other organizations is that there's a shift in how people are operationalizing diversity, equity, and inclusion. I think historically, when people think about diversity and being inclusive, they often think about community engagement. How do we get voices to the table that haven't been historically heard? And while this is important, I think there's not a new recognition, but a new shift in how people are applying diversity, equity, and inclusion within their jobs to be more comprehensive and more strategic. And so I think that means that people are looking at internal policies such as hiring practices and how do they create leadership positions. That also means how do they build budgets and how do they include and elevate these types of concerns and considerations? And how do they create inclusive and welcoming workplace cultures for everyone as well?
I think what's been standing out for me is people are kind of, they've grasped the concepts of diversity, equity, inclusion for the most part. Or that's the assumption that many folks feel who are concerned about including DEI within their work. While I know that there's still some work to do around making sure that the aspects of DEI are representative across more diverse audiences, I do think that folks really, really want to know how to take action and how to implement these principles within their own work, their lives, both as individuals and as groups and organizations. And that gives me a little bit of optimism because, you know, Mike and I are both potentially early career folks. We are the leaders of the next generation, and we recognize that all of the work that has come before us. Though I think now folks are really wanting to make that change and turn that page. I think there's been a more recent acknowledgement of systemic racism across the U.S. society. And, you know, the summer after the murder of George Floyd, there were a lot of organizations that wanted to step up and acknowledge through a statement of solidarity the anti-racism or the racism that has been present across much of our work. And so it gives me a little bit more optimism that folks are being more specific about and intentional about the actions that they're taking to address many of these systematic problems.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you are optimistic, both of you. So thank you, Melissa and Mike, for sharing your expertise on diversity, equity, and inclusion in the Salish Sea region from the perspective of a marine science and policy professional. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
This is Marianne Wagner, and you've been listening to Coastal Cafe, a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the UW College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. Washington Sea Grant helps people and marine life thrive by providing research, technical and expertise, and education that support the conservation of our ocean and coastlines. I'd like to thank our station manager, Larry Stein, and production engineer, Jared Dufresne. And as always, a special shout out to the band Kooeaks for their sharing of music with us at the open and closing of this program. And thank you for listening. Have a good day. Hingin ani, hatu asibu, ha.